Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host a conversation with an individual whose inner journey inspires us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. Awaken Calls are an all-volunteer-run offering of Service Space, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world to create a more compassionate and service-oriented society. Thank you for joining us.
Right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. My name is Audrey, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. As you may know, the purpose of these calls is to share stories, and there are stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation along the way. And we do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us to live into a more service-oriented way. Behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. And today, our special guest speaker is Greg Smith. And thanks so much for joining today's call. We will start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into this space. To get started, our moderator today is Preeta, and she will introduce our guest, Greg, and get the ball rolling in this conversation. And just to kind of share a bit of context on Preeta, who's an amazing individual, she's spent her career at the highest levels of public service, law, the corporate world, and academia, and including serving as a senior policy advisor in the Obama White House, helping draft constitutions in Afghanistan and Iraq, as a Federal Human Rights Commission chair and U.S. diplomat, and then being on the senior management team of the world's largest bank and a partner in a major global law firm. And on top of that, teaching at Harvard and MIT. And now, with a lot of kind of impact in the world, she's focusing on social change from the inside out and from small ripples rather than external mandates or norms. And she's an active service-based volunteer who does a lot of invisible service day in and day out. So Preeta, it's great to have you moderating this conversation, and I'll hand it over to you to introduce Greg.
I'm really excited to be in conversation today with Greg Taven, what an amazing, amazing person he is. He is really at the forefront of building local community in this country and in parts of this country that have long been ignored. He's inviting people to build the communities they want to live in. Greg is in Fargo, North Dakota, which is where he grew up, and he's doing a number of different initiatives, including having co-founded Emerging Prairie, which is a startup news and events organization, which we'll have some conversation around with him. He's also the curator of TEDx Fargo, and the host of something called 1 Million Cups, which supports local entrepreneurial ecosystems. He's an adjunct professor at North Dakota State University's College of Business. And I think most importantly, he's really changing what it means to harness the power of our communities and to improve the human condition. So, Greg, thank you so much for being here today and in conversation with us.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here.
Great. So, I thought we would just start a little bit with talking about your connection to your community. You've committed yourself to building local community in Fargo, North Dakota. Can you tell us a little bit about your connection to that place and kind of how it's come about through generations?
Yeah, so I'm a fifth generation North Dakotan. I grew up in a rural environment where my family homesteaded five generations ago. And growing up and going to school in the 90s in Fargo, North Dakota was the only state in the United States that had a declining population from 1930 to 2000. There were a lot of discussions amongst the brain drain that the best and brightest were leaving. So growing up, I thought the worst possible outcome for my life would actually be to live in North Dakota. But I grew up with a different environment than some, where I had a family that was in a rural basis, where very deep connection to our family church, very deep connection to the neighbors, And neighbors for us were people that lived 1 to 20 miles away. They were considered our neighbors in the rural environment. And so I kind of grew up learning these incredible values from my family and the community, but almost disregarding them as thinking there must be bigger and better things where the smartest people were in the urban environments on the coast. So I appreciated my upbringing, but I was always kind of told there was something better for me. If I was somewhat smart, if I had any ambition, I'd have to leave to do anything meaningful with my life.
Wow. So how did that come about and change for you?
Well, so I left. When I graduated, I went to the University of Minnesota. I went on a journey of starting a student organization that was committed to doing pay it forward tours. And I think at the University of Minnesota, where there were 55,000 students on campus, and the University of Minnesota, if it was a city in North Dakota, would have been the third largest city in North Dakota, just the campus, I craved that community. And so I think that's when I began my pursuit of building community on campus, building community with my peers. We started a student organization, which became a national nonprofit. We spent 7 years doing service trips called Pay It Forward tours. I burned out, wandered around the world for a year. And in my wandering around the world, all I longed for was where I started. I longed to know my barista. I longed to know my neighbor in the way that my family knew their neighbors. And I came home in 2011. And started building community with maybe a different approach than my family had over the generations, but with that same desire to know my neighbors.
Wow, that's beautiful. And there's so much to unpack in that short statement of what you just described of your evolution. So let's start. You left North Dakota, went to Minnesota for college, where you, I think you said 55,000 students or something. And then you started a student organization where you did Pay It Forward trips. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Like, what were these trips, and what does Pay It Forward mean, and how did you come to embrace that?
Yeah, sure. So was a freshman at the University of Minnesota, living in a residence hall with 800 people in my building. I've got a curly afro at the time. I had just been back from summer camps, and my ankles and neck were dangling with bracelets to remind me of these amazing people I'd met. And where I had been previously was in Australia. And when I was in Sydney, I was with the folks that ran the National Student Leadership Forum on Faith and Values. And they told me this story of these guys that wanted to do something good for their country and could use a little bit of a break from their wives and kids. And so they used the idea of the pay it forward model, which had been made popular in the Kevin Spacey's movie or in Katherine Reinheid's book, Pay It Forward, where they took college-age students on a trip around the coast of Australia doing service work and then telling stories of their journeys in the communities. And so when I got to the University of Minnesota, there were four of us that sat up late eating Top Ramen and Easy Mac saying, hey, we should change the world. Why not us? Let's get our classmates on a bus and go from Minneapolis to Washington, D.C. over spring break. And let's do a service project. Let's pay it forward. Let's go do community service in five different communities and then explore these communities. And so we did. The idea was hatched in September. March of 2004, we had our first pay it forward tour, and 43 people traveled. And it was this incredible journey for us as young people to explore communities that weren't the ones we grew up in, asking nothing in return, in just the spirit of paying it forward, which began, you know, the beginning of Students Today, Leaders Forever.
Wow, that's amazing. So in all of that time when you were working with youth and, you know, trying to foster these kind of acts of kindness for weeks on end at a time during these tours, what did you learn in terms of how to teach young people about kindness or how to foster that?
You know, I think we learned that it took an invitation, that asking someone, hey, do you want to go on this trip and help? Some folks were coming because they needed friendship. It was a better alternative than going home for spring break to serve others. For some, they were going because service was their thing. And what I learned in working and going on, I went on 25 Pay It Forward tours. I think I just learned that anyone can serve, and service does not discriminate on age, gender, sexuality, religious orientation, financial resources, but anyone has the ability to serve. And we did. And the real value of service was what was happening to us on the inside as we were connecting with ourselves, we were discovering our path, and we were building friendship in the spirit of service. And I think it was at a time where Facebook was just coming online, the digital connections were just becoming available. But to all of us, it was really a way to make a difference and do something meaningful. It was a counterculture to the MTV spring break, go to a warm environment, drink a lot of alcohol, maybe make poor decisions. But it was like, hey, we're a generation that cares, and we want to do something positive for others.
Wow. So can you just walk us through or kind of give us a visual of what these tours look like? Like how many people usually showed up on some of these? Like what did these acts of service look like when you showed up and let's say you went to Washington, D.C.? What did that look like?
Yeah, so kind of as the organization evolved, we would charter buses from different college campuses. So we would get a big charter bus. And 35 to 45 folks would pile on. They're bringing their suitcase, they're bringing their sleeping bag, they're bringing their pillow, they're bringing some snacks, and they get on the bus. Some would have had a few friends going on the trip. Some might not know anyone. So we'd go from Minneapolis to, say, Madison, Wisconsin. And we would travel by bus, and on the bus there'd be bus games. We'd get to know each other. We would play bus twister. And then we would arrive in a community, say it's Madison, Wisconsin, and we would find a community partner that would be willing to host us. And they may have us stay in a synagogue, a YMCA, a school. And we would come in the evenings, we would do get to know you activities. We would be exploring self, and sitting in a circle. And then, you know, people would stay up late chatting. We wake up in the next morning, we would do 3 hours of service. So maybe in Madison, I remember once, we worked at a senior home, and our role was to capture the stories of the residents. So I remember meeting the first ever University of Wisconsin cheerleader. And so we were just capturing her story for her family or for the community. We might play games in the memory care unit, just spending time with folks. Then we might do a tour of the University of Wisconsin. We might explore something interesting in the community. And then we would travel 3 to 6 hours to our next city on that bus ride. We'd reflect on what we learned. We would take naps, and then we'd be in a new city. Maybe we're in Chicago, and we'd work in a Latino community at Cristo Rey School. We'd stay in the school, learn about each other, wake up in the morning, do a direct service project, and then travel. And then when the organization got bigger, all the buses would converge together in Washington, D.C. So 6 to 8 buses would gather. We'd often do a huge project in the Anacostia neighbor, where I've spent so many hours cleaning up that river, pulling out tires, shopping carts, microwaves, and we'd get to know the local organization and learn about the history of the neighborhood. And then all these buses would converge, so it'd be 300 people in the same yellow T-shirt, and then later that evening there'd be a huge celebration where each of the buses would share stories of what they learned, what they saw, their impact, and what they were going to do about it. And we were the mission of the organization was to reveal leadership through service, relationships, and action, serving others in the communities, building relationships with one another, but then challenging ourselves to apply what we learned and make a positive impact in the lives of others.
That's amazing that as a college freshman, you created an organization that would, you know, bring 3 or 4 busloads of people, 300 or so, and end up having this kind of an impact. I guess a couple things come to mind in that. One, you know, you were clearly a leader that could organize people, even growing up as a young person. You organized and served people. What was your relationship to power and privilege growing up? Did you have models, role models of leaders that you respected or admired?
I mean, I think that was part of my university journey. So the co-founders of the organization, 3 of us were white men from rural environments, and one was a woman, a Filipino woman from Carson, California. And it was interesting. It was, we led the organization in a core model where the four of us had equal power and responsibility, decision-making authority. And so we'd have to make decisions based on consensus. And we believed early on that the strength of the organization was this, would be preceded by the strength of the leadership core. And so because we committed to that relationship with one another, we'd have weekly meetings for lunch where we weren't allowed to talk about work. We had to talk about our childhoods, our families, our hopes, our dreams. That was really helpful. And then as kind of a white Christian middle to upper class kid going to the University of Minnesota, which was so diverse, I think that's where culture really hit me, that not everybody grew up like me. Not everybody had the same background, the perspective, the origin. And so I really had a weird dance with power and privilege of trying to understand, you know, my inherent privilege, and then understanding just the dynamics of that. And at times it was comfortable, and at times it was incredibly uncomfortable, whether it related to the holidays of asking a woman if she was going to go and sing Christmas carols that Christmas. And when she looked me in the eye and said, or Hanukkah once, I was like, wow, my language, my worldview was around people just like me. But the University of Minnesota was such a diverse environment with classes, with professors, with students, that really helped me understand there was more to the world than just my upbringing.
Yeah, so I want to bring this back to this idea of pay it forward. I mean, you did these tours, these amazing college tours where you brought students from various campuses together. What was the pay it forward aspect of that, or what does that mean to you?
Well, I think, you know, when oftentimes folks would ask, why are you here? Why is there a bus of college, high school, or junior high kids doing this service work? We would bring up the story of pay it forward and how small acts of kindness could make ripples. And we hope they too would do service. They too would make a difference. I remember my freshman year of college, Irene, one of the co-founders and I flew out to California, and we went and met with the author of Pay It Forward. And she talked about her personal experience, how the bus or the book came to be when she was stranded on the side of a road with a car fire, and a random stranger just put out the fire, said, pay it forward, and left. She has no idea who that person was. And it just kind of resonated on a give first mentality of generosity, of doing things for others without asking anything in return, just hoping that these small acts of kindness make ripples. And that's kind of what I resonate with the service-based movement on, is, hey, let's just do small things, big things, but let's just love and serve others.
And at a time when, you know, especially in kind of the prairie where you grew up, the heartland, which is so much about individualism, finding your own way in the world, almost a pride about rugged individualism. How did you find resonance with others, or how did you talk about that in that context?
I mean, I think for some it was really hard. I was in the business school where all we were taught was to monetize, maximize profit, return resources for shareholders. And I didn't connect in my college environment within the business school. I found myself more interested in students from different, like the international students, or found myself interested with students that were more in the College of Liberal Arts. I really struggled with my academic peers. While we were there, one of our co-founders built the nonprofit major within the business school to support the academic pursuit of students that wanted to work in nonprofits like we did. And so it was difficult, but yet we found other social entrepreneurs. I remember we were part of a group of folks that had started social enterprises, and we just talked about benefit over profit. And we really got excited about this idea of learning or applying what we learned in business school to achieve greater impact for others.
That's
as
beautiful.
It relates to back home, I think it was hard. I think I got an opportunity to go to a great university. And when folks found out my first year of school, I made $20,000 and lived in my great aunt and uncle's basement. I think they thought I was just so foolish. Why would I spend that much time and money to, you know, make what I could have made as a junior in high school? But we were just motivated by something different. And that's where I kind of felt isolated and had to reach out to broader audiences and go to different retreats. Like, I met Audrey when I attended the Shin Yuen Foundation retreat in the Bay Area, where I found other people that were committed to service and was kind of motivated and energized. But I had to leave my area because kind of the pursuit was on, the encouragement was on the pursuit of independence. And yet I realized community isn't built through a bunch of folks that are independent. Community is built through those that can depend on each other.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if you've thought about or what, you know, what influences might have led you to be more drawn to these values. Are there people in your life growing up, or, you know, kind of historical figures, or what do you think kind of attracted you towards more of this sense of give first?
You know, I think it was the day-to-day role modeling of my parents. I remember when folks, these quote-unquote neighbors that were 1 to 20 miles away, someone would get sick. And then all of a sudden, for 3 or 4 weekends in a row, people would be gathered in our home, in our living room. Mom would provide food. Dad would lead a conversation of how are we going to help these folks? I'm a kid playing. I don't really understand. But 3 or 4 weeks later, I end up at a fundraiser where all those same people are, and they are raising money to support this family. Or a house would burn down. And all of a sudden, my mom would be part of organizing the neighbors on who's bringing the food, who's doing this, who's doing that. My dad, as a farmer, you know, the neighborhood had this kind of unwritten rule that if somebody was still in the field and another person had finished up for the day, they would just pop in and help finish up for the day. And at the end of the year, they would tally to see who, you know, if somebody ended up putting way more time in, they would compensate accordingly. But a lot of it was built on trust, and a lot of it was built on a long-term view of let's take care of each other. So I never grew up, you know, studying servant leadership, or I didn't, as a young person, getting told I had to volunteer in my community. My parents just modeled what it meant to be a good neighbor. And when someone was in need, you checked in on them. You helped them. My dad, I mean, like every holiday, he would run all these baked goods that my mom would make to the neighbors, and especially to the elderly folks in the rural community. And he wouldn't just go and bring the bars or cookies. He would go and spend time, and he would be present, and he would linger. And I remember as a kid being so annoyed on Halloween because I thought I was going to get candy. But my dad was using that opportunity to spend time with folks that weren't always in community, and he was getting to know them.
Wow, that's amazing. So I'm curious, with that upbringing, with kind of a background in agriculture, family background in farming, what drew you to business school?
I mean, I think it was the idea that I could make money. I think I was told I'm smart, I should make money, so I should go to business school. And I was incredibly unhappy until we started building a nonprofit. And I was very motivated on serving others, less motivated on serving shareholders.
Yeah. So let's fast forward a little bit. You finish business school, you're done with the University of Minnesota, and then there came a time, I think, where you traveled the world, right?
Yeah, I kind of burned out. I think in my experience with Students Today, Leaders Forever, I lost myself. I was more interested in the metrics of how big we were, how much money we had raised, how much staff. And it was during a labyrinth exercise, an inner journey exercise, where I realized I just needed to leave. And so I took a year to work with my co-founders to remove myself from the organization, had a beautiful transition. But I wandered around the world for a year. And I wish I could tell you I went to go see the great sites and meet people from all over the world. But I was actually just leaving my life. I went overseas so that my cell phone wouldn't work, so I wouldn't have great internet reception, because I had kind of lost myself. I didn't have hobbies. I didn't have friends outside the organization. And I really spent a year on an inner journey.
Yeah, that's amazing. So tell us a little bit about, I mean, I'm struck by your language. I lost myself. You say that very clearly. And with a lot of kind of clarity at this point in time, what did that look like as you were experiencing it?
So the first thing I did when I went on this journey is I went on the Camino de Santiago. It's a pilgrimage in Spain rooted in the Catholic tradition. And it was amazing because when I was on that walk, I walked for 37 days. Early on, when people asked me what I had been doing, I took all the credit for Students Today, Leaders Forever. My language was around self-importance. I took the collective impact and said it was all me. And it was just disgusting. But I was like trying to reclaim my identity. My identity had been built in my work. And it was just, I just felt really disconnected from self. I was more excited about headlines in the newspaper, and an extreme loneliness came under. I didn't really know who I was. I didn't have hobbies, and I knew I needed to interrupt my life to have a better sense of who I was.
That's an amazing amount of self-insight, self-awareness at a fairly young age. Did you have tools that you were able to tap into to help you get this inner clarity or awareness?
Well, not knowing. I think I had some guides that gave me some hints, but I went on the Camino because a friend had said it was an amazing experience, and the glow in his eyes. I didn't even know where it was. I knew it was in Europe, so I flew to Paris. I didn't have a map, but I got on the first day of the route, and I kind of got, you know, in the current of this experience, which all these people just come into your life and give you the hint or the question or the thought. I ended up in West Africa with Peace Corps volunteers. A young woman that I was dating at the time was stationed there, and I got all these incredible teachers, but it's not because they said they were going to teach me. I just was aware. And then I ended up in Sydney, Australia, in a really strong Christian community of just incredible service to one another. And these folks, I broke my ankle, and an elderly family took me in and nursed me back to health. And it just ended up being this incredible journey, but it was painful. It was difficult, but there weren't tools. There weren't guides. There wasn't a how-to book, but I just had this sense if I just explored, I would have a better sense. And I think the conclusion of that year over was I was enough. I remember reflecting on a bicycle ride in New Zealand of, I actually am enough. I'm not better. I'm not worse. I'm just enough. And that's all I need to move forward.
Wow. That's so beautiful. I'm not better. I'm not worse. I'm just enough. So what brought you back home after that? When did you realize it was time to stop running away? And then how did you make the decision of where to come back to?
So I get back. I had applied for a scholarship to study overseas at the University of Manchester in the UK, and I ended up getting that scholarship right after I got home. So I had $27,000 to study anywhere in the world, but I couldn't start until the 12 months from then through the Rotary Foundation. And so I thought I was going to go work in a school in Bismarck, and at the last minute, one of the most generous people I know said, Greg, come learn from me. Take a year, think of it as a leadership retreat. He was a gentleman involved in technology who had done very, very well and was trying to redefine our downtown. So I started to work with him. I lived in the urban environment, and I fell in love with Fargo. It was in 2011, 2012, helped plan the first TEDx event in North Dakota. And I decided to forego graduate school because I wanted to be part of the energy and excitement in Fargo. I had longed for a local community. I had longed to know my barista. I had longed for kind of that connectivity that happens with time. And so I said no to grad school. I've stayed in Fargo since 2011. And with some friends, we want to create a unique community that is inclusive, that is about the arts, which is about culture, but it's also about love. And so with a small group of folks, we've committed 20 years to trying to do whatever we can to improve the quality of life for our neighbors.
That's so exciting, and I want to spend a chunk of time talking about what you're doing in Fargo now. But before we get to that, coming back home, just that process of coming home, you mentioned that smart people, quote-unquote, were supposed to go away. What was the reaction of those in your community, those in your family, when you came back home?
Well, for anybody that has gone on a longer journey, they would know reentry can be difficult. So I had spent a bunch of time in a village in West Africa, and I came home wanting to cook different foods. I came home wanting to live without a car. I came home almost resenting money. And so I think I just had a really hard time connecting with my family, connecting with friends in the area. And so I kind of rebuilt some new friendships. There were some graduate students in the area that I kind of got to know. But at first it was actually really, really difficult to reenter. And then I think folks were surprised that I wouldn't go to grad school because they valued the graduate degree. But that it never really was much of a distraction because it was so clear to me to just make my community better. And I had Yeah, I just think I don't even remember any struggle around that. It just seemed so obvious, and the doors were open to just help and make a difference. And there's been no strategy underneath my work other than responding to the call and the opportunity to make a difference. A faith mentor of mine had explained to me what a call was. In 2010, I had done some study out at Stanford on social entrepreneurship, and my friend was a former Stanford professor telling me that a call is generally three things. It's downward mobile, it seems impossible, and you can't get it out of your head. And Fargo in 2011 was downward mobile for me. It seemed impossible. What would I do? How would I make an impact? And I couldn't get the thought of staying in Fargo out of my head. And so I just kind of, how would I say it? I would say I just kind of said, I just consented to, okay, I'm just going to trust whatever it is that is pulling me to this place that everything is seems possible to do it.
Wow. I love that. I love that definition of a call too. So you're now in Fargo. You've been there since, I think, 2011 is what you said. Love to talk about the different things you're doing, and you can talk about them in whatever order you're comfortable. There's Emerging Prairie, TEDx, the 1 Million Cup. So maybe we can start with, like, how did you go about, before getting into any of these, like, mechanisms, how did you go about thinking, how you're going to interact, how you're going to work to build this community?
Well, I think we just kind of stumbled into it. Right when I got back after wandering around the world for a year, I was invited to give a TEDx talk in Minneapolis at TEDx Twin Cities. And I ended up giving a talk on the unlearning curve, all the things I had to unlearn from business school when I wandered around the world to be a better version of myself. And so I told the curator, if I give a talk for you, will you coach me on how to create a TEDx event in Fargo? And he did, and he followed through, and he was great. So that was kind of the first project. And then we ended up doing three TEDx events that summer. And the events were selling out and people were responding. We wanted to have great talks from a variety of folks. We wanted to have great food. We wanted to be in a very safe, art-inspired environment. And the response was so strong. And it was during those TEDx's where I decided not to go to grad school and stay. And then a group of friends said, hey, we have to help our local folks tell their stories better. There's so many heroes in North Dakota, but as kids, we were very impacted by Scandinavian culture, and so those stories weren't always told. People would often devalue their work, talk less about it. So we wanted to tell those stories. So there was 14 of us gathered. We were going to have an online content blog to tell the stories of the entrepreneurs, and I think we produced two articles from it. But what ended up happening is all of a sudden this energy grew around Startup Weekend, and we did Startup Weekend, and that gave us a community, and we started to engage the community and connect the community. And this groundswell of activities of people volunteering, contributing to throw these events and create these possibilities. And what we found was that community was sticky. And for me, that's why I didn't go to grad school. I just wanted to be part of this community of contributing to supporting entrepreneurs, supporting risk takers, supporting problem solvers. And it's been one of the most intriguing journeys of my life.
Wow. You know, one thing that really, so your TEDx event, I believe, is one of the biggest TEDx events, you know, around the world. And one thing that continually comes from, it seems like, your involvement, whether it's that or 1 Million Cups, which is one of the biggest, one of those chapters in the world, or, you know, your student organization back in college, you know, you have an ability to drive scale, and I know you kind of bristled at that earlier when you realized you were broken. But what do you think you're able to do that's able to make your events become such big draws?
So it kind of goes back to what my parents did, which is they gave first. And so our premise is to give first. And for TEDx, the organizing principle for the team is to write a love letter to our audience. How do we create a day and a half of experiences, which is a love letter to them, where they're cared for, where there's an intention to detail, where there's maybe a food they haven't tried before or an inclusive environment they haven't seen. We have prayer rooms for folks. We have gender inclusive bathrooms. We have food choices that meet all folks' needs. We have an ASL interpreter. We have we have a premise that we want to make sure that everyone is welcome, everyone is included. We have childcare available for folks. And so we really think about reducing barriers for entry. So when we reduce barriers for entry, whether it's price, whether it's access, whether it's some sort of limitation, more people can participate. The other thing is the amount of energy and love, and we believe we cannot outgive our community. And so each year we serve, we create these environments, and I think that there's a response to that. As a Christian, I believe I can't outgive God. But as a, you know, maybe a more secular approach to that would be we can't outgive our community. And so we just try to give as much as we can to our audience. And I think that people respond to that. I think people respond to the marketing tool of love. When we truly love others, people respond and they want to be part of that environment. So it's back to the same things we learned at Students Today, Leaders Forever. If we kept the core of our team in a positive environment, there were more positive ripples that would occur.
That's beautiful. So, and how does that intersect with your business, the business world that you also grew up in? You know, I'm, when you talked about Students Today, Leaders Tomorrow, you talked about fundraising. You know, when you talk about providing this amazing food for your TEDx attendees, I mean, there is, you know, there is some financial energy that goes into that as well. And I'm just curious, how does Pay It Forward show up in your life now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tension. It's a challenge. How do we aggregate the resources? Nipun, who I think many of you have met, he gave me the best business model principle of any book I've read, any speaker I've heard, where he was sharing with me that some people use the approach of a community and a tree. And if a tree adds value to a community, the community will water and nurture it. But if a community or if a tree does not add value to the community will let it die. And so we've had this abundance mindset that if we add value to the community, it's all going to work out. Now, that's been difficult for my teammates when there's a deficit, when there's things aren't going well. But having been doing this for 7 years now, it always has worked out. And so we've had to really work hard on the problem we're trying to solve, the inclusivity. My business school background is nice because it gave me a language to connect with a corporate CEO or a bank leader to kind of use their language. And then it's just been about building relationships and adding value and demonstrating if people want to solve a certain problem and we align with that, maybe their resources could be helpful. And it just seemed to just show up, but it takes a lot of work on relationship building, on the invitation to help us solve the problem and including people in the journey.
Yeah, there's, I think you can be a teacher to so many. As Nipun has been to you, I think you can be a teacher to so many as we start unpacking a lot of those issues. I'm wondering if you could talk, well, let's just continue on TEDx. Did you have a particular favorite moment? And I'm sure you've had many favorite moments, but what are some that stick out for you?
So TEDx, we've done 9 of the events so far. The last few years, we've had over 1,500 people at them. This year, we're expecting around 2,200 people. When we do our curation, we look at what are challenges in the community and who might have an idea somewhere in the world to help solve that problem. And then we bring in headliners. So we've had big names, Olympians, corporate folks, celebrities. But I think one of my favorite talks was last year, where a high school student that we met through our open call process gave a talk about what it means to be a Muslim female in Fargo, North Dakota. And for some reason, the only technology challenges we had the entire day were her talk. So she had to open up with, "I am a female Muslim," 3 consecutive times. And there was just this tension. What would she say? At that time in the community, there was some hate crimes happening. There was just some really poor treatment of her community. And she gave this amazingly positive, powerful, uplifting talk about her journey, her hope, what she had done at her high school to increase awareness and understanding of backgrounds from different parts of the world. And my crowd, our crowd, gave her a standing ovation. They didn't give a standing ovation to the celebrities, to the fancy folks. They gave it to the young woman that spoke from her heart with courage to tell her story. And I'm like thanking her and crying and she's shaking. I had dinner with her a few weeks later. She said that she works at Target, at the retail, and people are coming up to her, getting photos with her, giving her money. They just wanted to say thank you. And I watched the confidence in this young woman grow. And it was just so, so special for me.
Beautiful. So you're also running an incubator of sorts for startups, Emerging Prairie. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Like, first of all, just
yeah, so
the name.
Emerging Prairie is a social enterprise that is the umbrella of our TEDx Fargo, 1 Million Cups. It's kind of the organizing entity where our team kind of creates these sub-communities or these sub-events. And we exist to connect and celebrate the entrepreneurial ecosystem. Similar to a college student feeling vulnerable, I think an entrepreneur is vulnerable. Good days, bad days. And so we wanted to create an environment to support entrepreneurs. And we have a little different approach than some. Our approach is that entrepreneurs need access to each other, platforms to share their work, and customers. So we focus on the first two. We help them meet each other through retreats, meetups, gatherings, and then give them platforms at TEDx or 1 Million Cups. We have a big drone conference. We have an ag tech conference. So we give them the space to share their ideas. We do not help on customer acquisition. And what's been special is that there's like four community principles that drive our work. They're educating our community. How do we create more opportunities for learning and awareness? How do we infuse the arts in everything we do? So we have almost all of our events in arts venues. We try to hire artists for performances, for creative exercises. We believe in building on our bright spots. We don't want to be the next Austin, Texas, or Bangalore. We want to be the first Fargo. So we try to find the value add that we have and build on it. The last is to practice radical inclusivity, whether that's food choice, time of day, honoring of holidays, price points. And then the last one, which is the one that's unpublished, which comes from the whole service based world, is just how do we increase the amount of love in our community? How can we go the extra mile to serve people that show up? How can we serve our teammates? How do we provide love and care to an elected official, to the new person in the community or the person that's been there for generations? How do we love and support them?
I was going to ask you how love fits into all this, so that's beautiful. It's one of your guiding principles. Can you give an example of I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you give an example of how that principle has been applied?
Yeah, so I think of our speakers. They fly in to give talks. We'll have a concierge service set up where someone, you know, there's a bank in town that gets 150 volunteers for TEDx organized. And these folks will pick our guests up from the airport, and they'll have chocolate-covered potato chips that are unique to the region, and they'll have a bottle of water, and they'll give them a tour, and they'll just welcome them to our community. They'll go to their room, and there'll be a fruit basket or a gift or a kindness. There will be a dinner for them that is beautifully designed with local arts and entertainment, and the whole process for that speaker is designed to help them with their idea. We'll introduce them to people like them, people they want to work with, folks that can apply their idea, whether it's in education, service, technology. And I think that kind of that spirit of love shows up when people describe, the common way people describe our work is, I don't really know what they do, but I really love the energy. And I think when people talk of positive feelings towards energy, they're actually describing love. They just don't know how to use that word to articulate their positive feeling of feeling welcomed, of included, a part of something.
Yeah, it's extraordinary that you've been able to use kind of traditional platforms, somewhat mainstream platforms like TEDx, like, you know, these kinds of entrepreneurial ecosystem support, and infuse them with love. That's really unique.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the teams that I've worked with care. You know, they care about others. They do the little things. They go the extra mile to just support others. And then as a, you know, a part of their team, I try to create pathways where, you know, don't let resources be available or be a barrier to doing that. Please don't feel uncomfortable doing the extra piece. Know that that's celebrated. But on the flip side, there's the negative, because our team, you know, we struggle with burnout. Our team struggles with anxiety at times, because there's a pressure that has fallen on us. So Currently one of the challenges that we're trying to design for is how do we build a rhythm in our organization for rebirth, re-energizing, giving people the space to rest versus the go, 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 more, more, more. Because one of the challenges of success is the responsibility, and then people want us to scale or go to other communities or do bigger or stronger. Where we're trying to take an inventory on the inside is what are we capable of? And then how can we design a structure where we don't have burnout, where people don't move on because they just get exhausted?
Yeah. So do you have turnover in your organization? How do you manage that?
We've certainly had it. And I think a lot of that falls on me. I failed to realize that my teammates, which are mostly millennials, wanted to know their career path. They wanted to know what was coming. For a while, the organization was, worried about staying alive. And so the focus was on survival versus abundance. And so just within the last 6 months, we've really started to think about rhythm. How do we build a rhythm? How do we create space for folks to grow and develop? And then also, how do we create more spaces for co-creation, giving more people the opportunity to build and grow? There's been a challenge when new teammates come and they resist some of our models. They resist an abundance mindset. They resist a give first mindset because the world has kind of taught us to be transactional. Get mine, take this. And so as the team is coming on and they're starting to realize that it does work, we're watching the strength grow.
Yeah, it's how do you?
And for me, I've had to do self care. I've had to take. In 2017, which was arguably one of the most, I would say probably maybe the biggest yield of my journey, I took more time off.
Mm-hmm.
I took the most amount of time off in a single working year was last year, and yet the yield was the strongest. So it's a reminder for me to rest.
Mm-hmm. And when you say yield, how do you measure that? What's
outcomes,
yield?
Impact. I heard more positive ripple stories.
Yeah.
Maybe it's an agriculture term.
So a couple of, there's so much I would love to continue to cover with you, but I do want to open it up in about a few minutes. So let me just ask a couple questions now that you mentioned agriculture. You're working to bring tech, and kind of, drones, I think, and other things in new opportunities to Fargo in an area of the country that's really been committed to agriculture. How do you think that's impacting people's sense of place and connection to land and the agricultural rhythms of that place?
Yeah, I think it's a great tension point. It's also, I would bring up generational, right? There's the generational transfer of responsibility on the family farm unfolding. We have a low employment in our region. And I think back to when the U.S. went from a horse-drawn carriage transportation methodology to the car. And there was great concern, as we were moving to a machine-powered vehicle. And what I think about it as a connection to land, I think it brings interesting points of view. It brings a point of view on, does technology replace humans' work? Does it replace the need for individuals? My sense is it actually has a chance to create more community. Folks can have different types of employment, different types of engagement, but they may just have more time to be together versus to be isolated working. I'm of the viewpoint that technology improves the human condition. We create more food for more folks to create more access. And maybe that's a bit too optimistic, but yet I'm watching technology serve as a replacement for jobs that are really, especially in the drone industry, are dull, dangerous, and dirty. A lot of the solutions that technology is solving for are around really dangerous jobs. I mean, I think about in North Dakota, we have a lot of blizzards. It's a cold climate, and drones are now able to fly over power lines and check if the power line is working versus sending a human out in a negative environment. My hope is this technology can reduce pain points for folks and create a safer environment for folks to live and work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to touch a little bit about your spiritual upbringing and kind of your spiritual development. You've touched on that a little bit and talking about, I think your Christianity, is that your heritage?
Yep. That's my heritage and my current practice.
Okay. So can you tell a little bit about how important that was for you growing up, maybe if and how that's shifted over time and, whether you've kind of drawn from other traditions as well?
So I grew up in the oldest Swedish Lutheran church in North Dakota that my great-great-grandfather helped build. Church was, as a kid, would go on Sundays, and it was more out of habit and obligation than real meaning as a younger person. When I went to university, I found my faith to be a strong pouring of connectivity, of origin, of strength, of comfort. But then in university, started exploring different practices, whether it's meditation, different spiritual journeys. And I would say now at 33 years old, I believe in Jesus. I subscribe to his principles of love, generosity, kindness. But I see so many of the core principles of many of the world religions as it's about love. And so I find myself comfortable in a variety of environments, really honoring other traditions. And it's kind of the core of what I fall back on when, hey, I got to make a life decision. It's falling back on my faith. It's the motivation. And I think, you know, for me, Jesus' experience is what drew me to wanting to serve others.
That's beautiful. And how have you found, like, you know, you've really embraced your Christianity, but in a way that doesn't see diversity as a threat, and without othering other people, other types of people. And I'm wondering, in a very conservative place like North Dakota, and I can say that because I'm in Nebraska and I understand that, strong conservative beliefs, strong Christianity, how has your openness been received by others?
You know, I think part of the beauty of working with entrepreneurs is they're generally open-minded folks, right? They don't do what they do unless they think there's another way. So I think I might be a little bit more insulated. But it's also just, you know, for me, I seek out opportunities to find folks of different backgrounds. And when folks, like yesterday or earlier this week, I was in an environment where there was a bunch of folks from India that are working at Microsoft in Fargo. And I just look forward to hearing about their stories, their traditions, what it was like to grow up in Mumbai or Bangalore. And, you know, for me, it hasn't been overly uncomfortable. When I get outside Fargo, that's where the disconnect can come in. Just some of the language doesn't feel very open. I've just heard some comments that I feel just conflicted, where I don't feel as if folks are really considering what it's like to be from a different place. They're not honoring their privilege. That can be really hard in the smaller towns. And I've struggled to know how to navigate that. I get frustrated. I get angry. And I've really felt confused. How do I want to show up? How do I have a conversation to maybe increase additional perspective?
Mm-hmm. Have you thought about how you can use your platforms, whether it's TEDx or Emerging Prairie or some of these others, to think about helping people become more conscious of privilege?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Last year at TEDx Fargo, coincidentally, the day after President Trump banned the transgender community from military via tweet, I'm not sure the ban actually happened, we had a young woman who is transgender give a talk on her journey. And it was nerve-wracking because we knew the sensitivity of our environment. We knew the sensitivity of the topic, and I was just worried. And she gave a talk, and there was a standing ovation led by a Republican governor. And I was just so, so excited. So we've had so many different varieties. We work really hard to find folks of different perspectives, different abilities, different backgrounds, especially in TEDx. Because we've got an environment where people are there to hear ideas, and they're a little bit more open-minded. And I think it's made a really, really big impact on helping people value more diverse perspectives.
That's awesome. And how do you scaffold speakers like that? You know, it's one thing to identify diverse voices, and then it's another to really help them tell their story in a way that they feel is true to themselves.
Yeah, so I think the TEDx Fargo team committed early to supporting a speaking coach and a design coach. So we have two women that are just amazing, and they they support the speakers, right? So they help them design their talk, they help them with visuals for it, they help give the talk of their life. And so by doing that over the last 9 events, we've definitely built kind of the reputation of the audience and of the speakers that we're going to work with folks. So it gives folks confidence. And then we try to connect them to past speakers so they can share their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes a lot of effort on recruitment. It takes showing up in a lot of environments, traveling, listening to referrals. And we found that it truly is magical when a bunch of diverse folks are able to share their talks and ideas in a mashup. And the crowd's really responding. But it goes back to our commitment to serve the audience really well so that the audience serves the speaker. And if the speaker is being served, the speaker will do its best to honor the audience. And so it's a cyclical environment where if we do it right, everybody wins.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's definitely a hard act. Sounds like you guys have been really, really skilled at doing that. So we're going to shortly go into kind of a more of a three-way conversation, bringing in Audrey and others who may want to help co-create the space. But before we do that, I wanted to just ask you kind of a bigger question, kind of zooming out across your many efforts to build community, whether at university, through the Students Today Leaders Tomorrow thing, or Emerging Prairie, or TEDx, or so many other projects. Are there any big lessons that you feel you've come away with or you're mulling over about building community?
Well, I would give maybe one lesson and one question. The lesson being having a long-term view generally wins. And so it's been said if you want to build community, it takes 10 years, and that 10-year clock starts over every single day. And so we've tried to set our vision 20 years out with a core group of us. And it goes into that idea, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And so trying to build togetherness with a longer journey to support the people in our community. The second is the question of how do I balance being a community builder and be in the community? And at times that's been really, really difficult. I've had several conversations with other community builders, and it's just a tension on, am I in the community or am I not? And where is my responsibility, and where does my participation, how does that blend itself? And that's been really, really hard for me over the years.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of how that tension might have come up?
So I think about at an event. You know, one person wants to get to know me. Another person interrupts and asks where the coffee is. How do I be present and serve and engage? And when different people expect different things at different times. And when we're just trying to be a member of the community, but then getting asked for things or pitched or persuaded, trying to be influenced, whether it's political, community issues, versus just being a member and showing up, it can just be really, really hard. When are we on? When are we off? How do we rest? How do we be ourselves? But then how do we show up when we don't have responsibility just to attend and participate like others do for our events and activities? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It's really, really well said. So I'm going to turn it over to Audrey for a bit of a more of a three-way conversation.
Great. Thank you so much, Preetha. And thank you, Greg. It's been so great to hear all these amazing insights and stories. I'm smiling really wide just listening and thinking about how I met you, I think, 9 years ago. and the journey that you've been on since. And along those lines, I'm going to just remind callers that if you would like to ask a question, feel free to hit *6 to get in the queue, or email ask@servicebase.org. If you're online listening, feel free to write in your question, and the queue is open for anyone that'd like to ask anything. But to kind of kick off our other Q&A portion, I mean, it's all Q&A, but to kick off this Q&A portion, I wanted to share something that Mark Wynn in Guernsey wrote. He really wanted to be part of this call, but had a conflict and couldn't make it. But he had written in this comment. He said, "Greg doesn't fully get this, but he has been a huge mentor to me. Just observing how he carries himself in his community has been fundamental to how I behave and act. I would go as far to say that in the field of grassroots community building, he has been one of my biggest influences. The mantra of his to create the place that you want to live in and how he lives and breathes that in everything that he does has been fundamental to the way we do things. The Dandelion Foundation and its mission to make Guernsey the best place to live on Earth by 2020 would not be the same without his influence. He is not only changing his community with how he is and what he does, he is changing the world as well. So those are some really kind words from Mark, and I feel like I'm sure there's so many people that would have similar comments having known you. But along those lines of kind of mentorship, I'm curious to hear a bit more about, like, who have been kind of your key mentors and what have you learned from them?
So I think in high school, and that's very nice comments from Mark. I'm nearly tearing up because Mark is somebody that I look up to and have learned with. I think in high school I had a Spanish teacher, Mrs. Scott, that helped me understand about how to engage with folks that maybe had different backgrounds, getting people included. She was kind of the wise old soul that called my bluff as a, you know, ornery high schooler. And then I think kind of in current times, you know, I have a learning partner, Scott, in Brookings, South Dakota, who does community work where we've done a lot with that. There's a gentleman in Kansas City named Andy Stoll who works with the Kauffman Foundation, who is just driven deeply into community. And then, you know, Nipun from Service Space is somebody that I've long looked up to, and I would say mentorship through observation of just kind of the commitment to service, even the idea of Service Space, of the invisible volunteers that countlessly serve so many of us folks and pull the invisible strings, as they like to say, to change the world. That's played a really, really big influence in my life. I'm also reminded of Les Anderson, who was a principal in Minot, North Dakota, that used to run student council conferences. And I think the key takeaway for me about Les was he always let students have the microphone, and he let a lot of people say a lot of things versus some environments have one person talk, say a lot of information, but not share the microphone. And I think if we want to live in a world where everyone feels valued, we have to pass the microphone and give more people the opportunity to have their voice heard.
Yeah, right. That's a great one. kind of along those lines too, and just listening to you share, I'm struck by this kind of balance between you personally being the change that you wish to see in the world and then kind of designing, you know, spaces for that kind of change to take place in systems. And how do you kind of negotiate that, you know, those scales of working on an individual personal level and then zooming out and working on kind of a systemic or cultural level?
Yeah, I think that is, I wish I had a better answer for this one. You know, I think for me, I get together every Friday with a group of friends and we talk about our faith and we talk about community, and there's a lot of small encouragements on how do we do it in our own lives. And a lot of that looks like, how do I love and support my wife? We have a new baby at home, and so how do I care for my baby, or our baby, or this wonderful baby we get to care for? And so I think that's kind of where the inner work is coming at. How do I treat myself? And then how do I treat my wife and my daughter? At a community level, that gets difficult because, you know, as a leader of an organization that has fiduciary responsibilities, that manages a team, how do I coach, mentor? I don't know how to manage. I'm an awful manager. Ask anybody that I've ever had the chance.
I find that hard to believe.
but I struggle with it. And I find that I have a stronger ability to encourage volunteers than I do paid staff. And that's been a tension for me, because volunteers, it just seems a little bit more natural because the transaction has been removed. But then how do I interact as somebody paid to do something with someone else who is paid to do something? And how does responsibility and accountability work? That's been a challenge I've had.
What have you learned from that kind of tension or dynamic?
What are you learning
as you experiment with it?
Well, I think I've, you know, unfortunately allowed my life to create an environment where I'm very time poor. And in a professional environment with teammates, when I'm time poor, I'm a little bit more quick to a message, stern, aggressive at times. Not necessarily aggressive, but I'm working right now. I was just doing some work on it this morning of how do I create more time capacity in my life to be more available for others. Because I think part of what attracts people to our organization is the ability to have relationships with the team. And I've been better at building relationships outside the team than I am at inside the team. And that's been a disconnect for me.
That's a great question of time. It's like the 21st century question.
Yeah.
So if you figure it out, tell us your tip. That's great. I also wanted to go back. You mentioned your wife and your little baby, and I'd love if you could just tell us about your family. Tell us about your wife. We hear a little bit that she runs a flower shop, and you're now a father to, I think, is it a 4-month-old daughter?
Not quite. 3 months. But yeah, so my wife, Christy, I just feel so grateful that I get to do life with her. We've been married for a little over 2 years. She's like patient, generous, generous, like without even knowing she's generous. She's kind, just a real, real amazing, patient woman that I'm so grateful I get to hang out with. She runs a flower shop called Love Always. It was named in honor of her great grandmother who used to sign her letters. Love Always, Grandma, Love Always. Then her grandma did that. Her mom did that. And so she happens to sell flowers, but her pursuit is to spread love and joy in our community. And so her team often goes the extra mile, gives a little bit more than they need to in the design, adds some fun elements, but they are trying to spread love and joy through floral design in our community. And it's like working. I feel like my wife's a celebrity where everyone's like, oh, I love her flowers. They're so amazing. And like, I just, when people find out that I'm married to her, it's like my stock goes way up because they're like, well, if Greg knows her, then he must be an okay guy. And then a little under 3 months ago, we were so fortunate to have a healthy baby, Harper Lucy, join us. Who, you know, being a new parent is quite a journey. But we named Harper, her middle name after a woman named Lucy, who, is a philanthropist in the Twin Cities, who is she's one of my heroes because she's this very unassuming woman that is just incredibly generous. And she's in her 80s and I've like gotten marriage advice from her, sex advice from her. Like I've just like felt so open with her. And so we wanted to name our daughter Harper Lucy after this woman named Lucy, who's an explorer, who's generous, who's open-minded, and like one of like my heroes, our heroes. And so that's kind of the little triad to our family right now.
Oh, that's great. And just, you know, as a new parent, what is parenting teaching you? I mean, at 3 months, it's like you're probably still underwater. with sleep and, you know, all the needs of a newborn, and then, you know, doing this other work too with the community. How has that been for you, and what have you been learning in that process?
Yeah, let me try to slice that from a couple of ways. One is, I think growing up, it was this idea of work and life as separated. And Christy and I have said in our family, we want our work and our profession, our work and our life to be blended. We want to be the same person at work as we are at home. And so my wife brings Harper to meetings with brides, into the flower shop. I've had Harper on stage at our events. We actually want to bring Harper into our work versus separating it. And I think I saw that in Burkina Faso, where the generations are much more integrated than in the U.S. culture with the different family members. The second is selfishness. I mean, I didn't realize how selfish I was until I got married. And then, you know, working with an adult was able to figure that out in a healthy way. But then having a child is really an exposure to selfishness. And so how do I love a child that can't give me anything? I mean, we just heard Harper giggle a couple of days ago, which was amazing. But I mean, she's giving joy and love, but there's not that response. There's not that connectedness. And so I think it's teaching about that. And then I also think about in the modern era of digital, you know, what are the baby's rights to photos online? Should we post photos of her? Should we not? What does privacy mean for a newborn? It's kind of confronting on what is a baby's rights, what are our rights as parents, and how do we interact with that? It's, we've had a lot of great conversations about what is appropriate and respectful for her.
Right. I wonder that all the time. I often FaceTime with my almost 2-year-old niece, and I feel guilty half the time, just wondering, am I exposing her to this whole world of, screens at such a young age? How is that impacting her development? So yeah, that's a great question, along with the privacy too. And thinking about that, even just shifting towards, just the next generation of youth. You're a relatively young person yourself. And you are also working with a lot of, millennials, and you also teach students in college. And so I'm curious, from your lens and your vantage point, what are you noticing are the motivating factors in youth today, and whether it's around community building or in your work, what do you see as
I just sense a real craving for belonging. I see, with my students, the students that really responded were the ones that felt comfortable finally going off script. You can imagine I have a non-traditional classroom, non-traditional teaching approach, trying to get voices heard, trying to get perspective, getting them to laugh, using humor. I just sensed a real craving for belonging. People want to be part of something. They want to have a role. They want to contribute. And how do we create pathways for them to contribute and be, to add value?
Oh, interesting. Can you share a bit about your unconventional classroom? I know, is this as an adjunct professor at North Dakota State?
Yeah, so this is the current one at North Dakota State University, where we just bring speakers in, to talk about the lesson of the day, and I interview them. But our assignments are around failure. Go try to fail 3 times. We do like summer camp models where we do interaction, and they come up with the worst idea possible, and they get into groups and they come up with like the worst company idea they could ever imagine. And then we give that idea to a different group. And then the next week they have to come back and tell us why it's a great idea. But just creating more play, more playing with ideas, playing with possibilities. Laughter is an amazing tool. And I think sometimes our education system is designed in such a rigid and kind of absolute way that I try to create an environment where we could ask the speaker funny questions, where we could, work on the worst ideas or play with the terrible concepts, but it actually helped teach them on what works and what doesn't. And what I saw there, I saw them come into the classroom, their personalities, their ideas. They started talking more. They started lingering after class. And I would jump up on a desk and ask a question or move around in mobility versus just sit and be talked to.
Yeah. Can you share an example of one of the worst projects or ideas that you've worked on?
One of the ones was quote unquote classic. But Fargo, it was to open up an ice cream shop in December where the average temperature is probably 0. But then, the next group figures out, well, you could have it as an ice bar. It could be mobile. You could have outdoor lamps and blankets and all these things. And people would come from around the world. And I'm like, wow, I would actually go somewhere that actually had an ice cream shop outside in a frozen tundra. Like, that would be actually really interesting. But maybe as somebody from California, you would be less interested. I think it'd be fun.
Well, I mean, yeah, it could be interesting. Here it rains and, we don't know how to drive on the streets. So yeah, I can imagine with the snow. That's great. One question that had come in online, is, around money and scale. So, this question is, can you tell us about your relationship to money and scale? It feels like you're all about relationship with the communities that you've been a part of, but money and scale are often at odds with that goal. How do you kind of negotiate that?
I just had an hour-long conversation on this topic earlier today. Just say there's tension, right? I've realized I can't scale myself. As individuals, we can only have so many relationships. And so how do we build teams to hold more relationships to do that? And the money thing is hard. I mean, my greatest concern in the organization is just believing in abundance, believing that money will show up. And there's a pressure on that. It's been difficult. It's been difficult to find partners that want to solve the problems, that want to share resources. But it's also been, there's a bit of humility in it of being able to ask. I remember there's a couple in our community that sold their company, and I know they want to be involved. And so I asked them for a large amount of money. And that's really embarrassing. And it's awkward because I don't have enough money to do this all myself. But there's been a huge tension. On the scale for TEDx or the different conferences, I don't quite feel the pressure there as much. There's definitely a drive to get more butts in seats to serve more people. But there isn't a desire for scale from a revenue perspective. Our 1 million cups, which happens every Wednesday morning, we have the largest attendance in the nation, but we don't charge anything. And it's just been, hey, let's serve more people and serve them better. I also am fortunate that we live in a very prosperous, generous community where folks are giving. I guess it's a rambling way of saying it's difficult. You know, when do we encourage scale? When do we respond to scale? Things we've started to intentionally keep small to contain and just have some more predictability as well.
That's great. It's definitely an interesting topic with no clear straight cut model or answer. So, it's really inspiring actually to just hear the way that you're living into those questions and really kind of taking action in a way to experiment around those designs. So thank you for that. One other question, I know we're running a little low on time, but one other question that came up was kind of going back to that year that you shared earlier on about wandering the world after Students Today, Leaders Forever, where you mentioned that you realized your identity was really wrapped up around your work. Since then, how have you integrated that insight into your life? You've done all this local work in Fargo, you've become a dad, gotten married, and, all these other things that, you know, in life. How do you kind of negotiate that difference between your identity and your work now?
Yeah, so I think on that year, I remember sitting in Chiang Mai, Thailand, drinking what I thought at the time was not a very good cup of coffee, but drinking caffeine and just really doing an inventory. And I felt as if I had a scalpel just scraping away part of my heart and just getting rid of the junk and the clutter and the noise. And so I think as it shows up now, it's actually, it's just creating space for reflection. I think walking to work helps. I think going to retreat. So I went to the Gandhi 3.0 retreat in Ahmedabad, which was really helpful to just be present. I think it's probably why I have a blended life approach where I do multiple things, but I just think I'm Greg. And I think my values are aligned with the organizations I work with. So I serve my values, whether than this organization or that. And I think it's like less thinking about quantity of retrospective of what we've done versus, you know, how I want to show up, how we want to show up, and then who we want to serve and how we want to serve them. I when I look back at my life, I'm just like so grateful for the lessons and the experiences, but I don't feel as if I'm my past anymore. I remember being very worried about being a one-hit wonder during the Students Today Leaders Forever journey. And then it was that one of our TEDx MCs said something. Her name was Tanya Stendi, that just really made a big impact. She said, you know, Greg, when I thought about MCing this event with 2,000 people, I was so nervous. And I was nervous because all I thought about myself. I thought about how would I sound? Would I be funny enough? Would I say a name wrong? But then I realized I need to serve the audience. And when I realized my role was to serve, I was no longer nervous because I had a job to do. It was to love and to care about the people in the room. And I think as that relates for me, and we tie it into identity, when I think more about the problems we want to help solve or the barriers we want to help reduce, it feels less about identity and more about a direction. And it gets into calling. And I feel as if I'm resisting the temptations of ambition and more to respond to be there for my wife or my child or whatever.
Right, right. That's
is that
beautiful.
Somewhat of an answer? Or is that,
it's
you,
total,
some...
it's definitely an answer. It's beautiful. And actually, I feel like, you know, it's, there's a tone in that that's so kind of just emergent, and there is no crisp, clear kind of you know, equation for that kind of lifelong exploration. So yeah, thank you so much.
And another helpful thing for me, this might be helpful for others, is I've just quit doing as much goal setting. I used to be very ambitious on goal setting. You know, we want to do this, we want to accomplish this, we want to do that. I've let go of that kind of westernized approach to ambition. And I just kind of think about value-based of how I want to be versus what I want to do. When I was wandering around the world for a year, I thought a lot about, am I a human being or am I a human doing?
Right.
And how do I set my life up to be a human being, not just a human doing?
Yeah, yeah. Another 21st century question.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Thank you. So we're kind of at the last few minutes of our call, and in that spirit, we have one final question for you before we close with a minute of gratitude. And that question is, how can our greater service-based ecosystem be of service to you and all that you are being and doing in the world?
You know, I think if somebody wants to come visit, that would be amazing. You know, our home is designed for visitors. And I think growing up in an area such as Fargo that is difficult to get to via flights or driving, it can be expensive. But just show up, come visit. That would be an amazing gift because it's so helpful when folks from other places come to visit versus we have to go visit them.
Mm. Wow. We ask you how we can serve you and you say, come visit. That's so beautiful. Definitely a reflection of all the relationships that you cultivate. So thank you so much, Greg. We'll close out with just a minute of gratitude and silence for this amazing conversation, for the journey that you are continuing to walk, and for all of us, for kind of co-creating this shared space to explore these journeys in a deeper way. And thank you so much. I mean, it's just from listening to you, I feel really inspired by the genuine way that you're kind of walking your talk and holding space for so many people in your local community, and just like really sincerely looking to be of service in whatever form that takes in Fargo, and the ripples of which reach so many other places of the world. So thank you so much, Greg, for being
Greg,
who you are.
And Greg, this
yes,
is Frida. I will definitely visit you in Fargo. So
awesome.
Yeah.
We got one. It might be the first one of 2018 if you get here soon.
Yeah, well, you better watch out. We might all caravan over sometime.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.